From WGCU News, this is Gulf Coast Live. The legal battle over the redrawing of Florida's congressional and legislative district boundaries continues this week with the announcement that the Florida Supreme Court will unseal additional documents related to the case. This follows the release of more than 500 pages of emails from Republican political consultants in late November. We explore what the unsealed documents reveal about the redistricting process and what's next for plaintiffs challenging the state's political boundaries. Plus, the federal government is currently investigating some 55 colleges and universities, including Florida State University, over how they handle cases of sexual assault on campus. A closer look at how school officials and students here in Southwest Florida are trying to address the issue. First, this news. From WGCU News, this is Gulf Coast Live. I'm John Davis. Thanks for joining us. Addressing the problem of sexual assaults on college campuses has taken a prominent place in the national conversation. A 2007 Department of Justice study reports that 1 in 5 women experience an attempted or completed sexual assault during their college years. The federal government has launched an investigation targeting more than 50 schools around the nation on how they deal with sexual assaults on campus. Later this hour, WGCU's Topher Forges takes a closer look at how school officials and students here in Southwest Florida are addressing the issue. But first, the legal battle over the drawing of Florida's congressional and legislative district boundaries continues this week with the release of additional documents and the ongoing lawsuits challenging how lawmakers came up with the new maps. The Associated Press reports the Florida Supreme Court is unsealing documents of a 2-year-old email exchange between Republican political consultants indicating changes to state Senate maps were intended to limit Democratic gains in the 2012 election. This follows the release in late November of more than 500 pages of emails from GOP consultants related to redistricting that had been kept secret during a 12-day trial this past summer. Those emails included exchanges with the Gainesville-based Republican consulting firm Data Targeting. The League of Women Voters of Florida is leading a consortium of plaintiffs, alleging that district boundaries were drawn to favor Republican candidates in political contests, which goes against anti-gerrymandering amendments Florida voters added to the state constitution in 2010. Joining me now to explore what the unsealed documents reveal about the redistricting process and what's next for plaintiffs challenging the state's political boundaries is reporter Matt Dixon. Matt is the Tallahassee Bureau Chief for EW Scripps, and his investigative and political reporting has earned numerous accolades and awards. You can follow his reporting in the Naples Daily News, among other Florida publications. Matt, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us is attorney David King with the League of Women Voters of Florida, which is leading the coalition of plaintiffs challenging the process of how state lawmakers redrew the state's district boundaries in 2012. David King, welcome to Gulf Coast Live.
Glad to be here.
And I invite listeners to join the conversation as well. You can connect with our guests by calling 1-877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. Send email to gulfcoastlive@wgcu.org. You can also post comments and questions on Facebook at WGCU Public Media or join the live Twitter chat using the hashtag GulfCoastLive. And Matt Dixon, let's start with you. I know you covered the initial 12-day trial this past summer when those 538 pages of data targeting documents, along with some witness testimony, was kept secret. In that case, Leon County Circuit Judge Terry Lewis agreed with plaintiffs and threw out the maps. New maps were approved following a special legislative session. Did you think at that time that the matter was settled for the most part, or did you anticipate further appeals?
No, I mean, I think I've always kind of anticipate appeals coming up of something as complicated and as controversial as this. There are so many kind of unique elements that surround this case. As, you know, the idea of tossing congressional maps is, you know, certainly something we thought these things would go to court. Once they went to court and were rejected, I mean, the idea that it was just going to be a dead issue at that point, I don't think anyone really expected an outcome like that.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's take us back to covering that trial. Why did Judge Lewis decide initially that the data targeting emails and some of that witness testimony would take place outside of the media and the public's purview?
Well, the non-parties, in this case, data targeting, the Gainesville-based firm that you keep referencing, they weren't actually parties to the underlying lawsuit. They're what are termed non-parties. They successfully argued that they should be protected by the initially didn't want their documents or to be submitted as part of the case or to have to give testimony or depositions. And Judge Lewis said, well, you guys do have to do that. We're going to include your documents as part of the case. We're going to make you guys give testimony, but we're going to close the courtroom when that happens. And we're also going to seal some of those documents. The media organizations and the plaintiffs fought that, but ultimately lost at the circuit court level, and it was later overturned by the Florida Supreme Court. The non-parties appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court, which that appeal was quickly rejected, and the documents have since been released.
Right. That was Justice Thomas there. And David King, to provide a little more background on how this case developed, can you explain to us the general argument that you successfully made in that case, back in August?
Well, we proved in the trial, the 12-day trial, that there was a conspiracy between the political operatives, the Republican political operatives that we had identified in Tallahassee and in Gainesville, and the legislature to violate the Florida Constitution, where the Constitution requires that no apportionment plan or individual district shall be drawn with the intent to favor or disfavor a political party or an incumbent. And, it's hard to prove a conspiracy. Nobody wants to confess that they've engaged in a conspiracy to violate the Constitution, particularly legislators who have been elected supposedly based on an oath to follow the Constitution. In this case, though, we were able to establish from the very start of the process that the legislators who control the House and the Senate were the same folks that had fought so hard against the amendments, that had filed lawsuits to stop the amendments, to place every hurdle in the path of the amendments. But those amendments got through. They were voted. Something like 63% of the people of Florida thought they were a good idea and that they ought to be in the Constitution. And then once they were in the Constitution, these legislators didn't like them any better than they did when they were trying to keep them out of the Constitution. And so they met with the political operatives, and we think the evidence established that they had developed a plan as to how they were going to still continue to get around those amendments, because they developed the notion that they were being transparent and open in the process. That was the legislature's mantra as they proceeded. And what we established was that there was a shadow process in the background where the political operatives continued to play the same roles that they played in prior redistricting cycles, and helped the legislature develop maps that were biased in favor of the Republican Party. And so that took a lot of evidence. We had 12 days of trial, bunch of witnesses. We put in the testimony of the political operatives that had attempted to influence the map, and, of course, the documents that were held out from public view, which were just recently released by the Supreme Court of Florida, helped establish that conspiracy, because they established that with witnesses that had denied any involvement in the mapping, the redistricting process, other than just general interest, turns out they had a factory up there in literally a factory turning out maps that to be provided to third parties to present the maps to the legislature. The maps ended up being relied upon by the legislature, and there was evidence to suggest that those political operatives let their friends in the legislature know which maps they ought to be relying on, and that they did. And so the judge found that enough to establish the conspiracy and to conclude that the political operatives had made a mockery out of the process.
All right. And David, can you tell us who some of the other plaintiffs are in this case besides the League of Women Voters?
there were some individual plaintiffs, and then there was a separate case filed by what is called, led by Renee Romo, the Romo plaintiffs, which involved the Democratic Party. That was a separate case, but that was tried at the same time with the case involving my clients, the League of Women Voters, and the individual plaintiffs.
And Matt Dixon, from one reporter to another, congratulations on scooping us all. Those documents were set to be made public on December 1st, but I understand your acquisition of those documents before that scheduled release date is actually what prompted officials to unseal the documents even earlier. Can you tell us about how you gained access to the records, or does that involve a confidential source?
Oh, my gosh, from one reporter to another, asking about sources. That's interesting.
No, it was, I know, really, I had to ask.
I know. I was joking. But, no, I really would feel uncomfortable getting into any of the specifics of how that process worked, as I'm sure you all know. But we were certainly happy to get a hold of them. There was a lot of information that needed to become public in there. So we were glad to be able to report them, be the first one to get them out there and to kind of to spur their early release. So it was a process we were certainly happy to go through. But as far as talking about stuff like that, as you well know, that's kind of a tricky territory.
Oh, sure. Regardless, can you give us some highlights regarding, you know, what you reported from what you found in those documents?
Yeah, a lot of things that Mr. King had touched on. First, many of them did focus on state Senate maps, actually, which there's another pending lawsuit that hasn't moved forward challenging the constitutionality of state Senate maps. And many of the emails themselves focused on those. But some of the interesting things from the congressional emails is this idea that Mr. King touched on, that there were people drawing maps and recruiting others to sort of submit them through the formal process. And one of the gentlemen that was highlighted prominently in that was a gentleman named Stafford Jones. He's head of the Republican Party in Alachua County. And there was a lot of email chatter about Mr. Jones recruiting people to submit maps, talking about Stafford's going to give us 10 more, or quotes like that. And that's really what some of the plaintiffs hit on as far as this, quote, shadow process that keeps being referenced. There are maps drawn, given to third parties whose names aren't necessarily associated with politics, and they inserted them as part of the process. I will say, just kind of have the make sure that listeners kind of have the other side of it. The non-parties, the data targeting to the world are simply saying that their kind of argument is, well, this is, you know, simply a group of like-minded people who are petitioning their government, which is allowed in the Constitution. So that's kind of the counter to it. But, you know, what they're saying is, and I believe they've said it in numerous court filings, is that the amendments, which they certainly did oppose, kind of create a quote, second-class citizen. And what they're saying is, just because we're political consultants and do politics professionally, does that mean we can no longer petition our government? So that's, you know, obviously for the court to decide. I just wanted to make sure that sort of both arguments were at least thrown out there for folks to decide on.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, you had quoted Mr. Boehner himself, Pat Boehner, the founder of data targeting, you know, arguing against the release of those private emails. And he said, quote, that it undermines his constitutional rights of any citizen who dares participate in democracy, end quote. Does he perhaps have a valid point there? Should his work as a GOP consultant preclude his ability to participate in the redistricting process the same way that any other citizen would have the opportunity to do?
Yeah, I don't quite make as much of an attorney or a judge, so I probably leave those if it's appropriate to other folks. All I will say is that's kind of been the underlying argument since, you know, for years now, since the amendments first emerged. You know, opponents of them have sort of cast them as sort of fundamentally flawed in the sense that we're talking about right now, while proponents, supporters of the amendment say, well, gosh, it's common sense to want to take politics out of the redistricting or the map drawing process. Mm-hmm. And that sort of underlying dynamic or that underlying argument has been there since the beginning, and it really emerged in a very concrete way as this case kind of, you know, is ongoing here.
Mm-hmm. And plaintiffs in the case had raised concerns that the maps were intentionally drawn to pack minority voters who usually lean more Democratic into single districts to make then the surrounding districts more Republican-leaning, which of course would lead to greater GOP representation. From your analysis of these, you know, formerly secret documents, does that confirm that that occurred?
I don't know if I can, in any concrete terms, and I'm sure Mr. King would probably have a different take, in any concrete terms that it doesn't. I will say, in some of the emails that were that came out, there was an exchange between Pat Vancer and a Tampa-based political consultant where they talked about consulting with attorneys and legal staff about ways to, quote, bring more population, end quote, into minority districts. And that conversation centered on the idea that there might be this way to give 5% less population, fewer population, in districts in the Florida Panhandle, which is a conservative-leaning area, and put them in other, you know, minority-leaning districts. So there was certainly talk about it. Now, if that, you know, concretely emerged or showed itself on the maps that were ultimately passed, that's, you know, a part of this case, and both sides are kind of disagreeing on that.
Right, right. We're exploring the latest developments in the legal battle over how state lawmakers redrew political district boundaries in 2012. More than 500 pages of documents from GOP political consultants that had previously been kept secret have now been released. You can join our conversation with legislative reporter Matt Dixon and David King, attorney for the League of Women Voters of Florida, which is the lead plaintiff in the lawsuit. Connect with our guests with your phone calls to 877-GCU-TALK. That's 1-877-428-8255. Join our live Twitter chat using the hashtag Gulf Coast Live, or post comments and questions on our Facebook page at WGCU Public Media. And Matt, if I remember correctly, that Tampa-based political consultant you had recently mentioned was also involved in conversations that would have to effectively retire long-term Pinellas County Congressman Bill Young. Can you tell us about that?
Right. Yeah, that was actually the sort of informal response, I guess, phone calls and text messages I got after that story was from many Republicans from Pinellas County who were kind of concerned about that comment. And Bill Young is now, since passed away, he was at the time the longest serving Republican in the House and in Congress, sort of a beloved figure there locally. And there was some, I don't have the exact language in front of me, but there was an exchange between the consultants and a couple of consultants about submitting this map that would do various things, including, quote, retire Bill Young, an indication that, you know, heck, Congressman Young is going to be moving on at some point. This map would just kind of to, you know, get that done sooner rather than later. And it rubbed some folks in the Pinellas County GOP the wrong way.
Mm-hmm. And there was another piece of information that you discussed in your reporting that came out of those unsealed documents involving the admission that former state Senator John Thrasher didn't actually live in his district. Is there really a lot of significance to that information now, given that Thrasher's out of the legislature and serving as president for Florida State University?
Well, everyone is it's sort of indicating since he's gone, it's not as big a deal. One and two, the idea, they're backtracking now. That email from Pat Vancer that said that, in my interview, I asked him about it, and he said, well, I misspoke, I didn't know. And I think if anyone were to get former Senator Thrasher, now FSU President Thrasher, on the record about it, he really hasn't chimed in on this. But he would say that he has his homestead exemption in St. John's County and the house there, things like that. My former paper was actually the Jacksonville newspaper, so this residency issue of his is something that I've covered going back to when he won his special election. He moved from Clay County to St. John's County to run in a special election, and sort of residency charges have dogged him ever since. This is sort of the most concrete admission that perhaps he actually did live in Clay County, which would have been out of his district. But both the consultant who said it and I think Senator Thrasher are kind of walking it back. So I don't think anyone's going to make real hay out of it.
Sure. And we should probably also note that, at least on paper, he did seem to live in his district. He did have a home where he took property tax exemptions as a primary.
I had written about this issue when I wrote for the Florida Times Union, and he did, I mean, on paper at least, he had a sunset exemption on his license plate with a St. John's County address. So that is certainly accurate.
Okay. And, you know, we had mentioned earlier that additional documents related to the case are being unsealed by the state Supreme Court. The AP reports that those documents include email exchanges related to congressional district boundary, or not congressional district boundaries, rather, but state Senate district boundaries. And you had mentioned earlier, Matt, that there is kind of a separate lawsuit dealing with district boundaries on the state level. But David King, do you think that those documents could, in effect, expand the scope of the lawsuit that, that you're leading with the League of Women Voters?
Well, yeah, you got to remember that there are two lawsuits, one regarding the congressional map, one regarding the Senate map. Now, during the trial of the congressional map, the court allowed us to put in evidence of the machinations of the political operatives and the legislature regarding the Senate maps because he considered that probative and relevant to the legislature exerting their influence, I mean to the political operatives exerting their influence on the legislature across the board. But obviously many of the documents that we got from data targeting are part of the whole case involving the Senate case maps as well, and that's something that we'll be addressing after we get this congressional map out of the way. It's also important, John, to recognize that Mr. Boehner, data targeting, and their documents are simply a piece of the whole. In other words, you have to fit that evidence in with the other evidence from the other political operatives and the evidence of what the legislature was doing to reach ultimately the decision that the court did. But the court found that the evidence from Mr. Boehner's documents was very helpful to him in evaluating and establishing that the plaintiffs in the case, my clients, had proved that there was a secretive shadow process of map drawing by the political consultants, which found its way into the enacted congressional map. That was a very significant and important finding. And the court found that these documents from Mr. Boehner were important in that respect.
All right. And Matt Dixon, you mentioned sitting down recently with Pat Boehner, founder of Data Targeting. And you note that, you know, as far as media interviews go, in the last 30 years, besides speaking with you, he's maybe done one other one. Did he give you a sense of why he agreed to speak with you now?
Yeah, his firm's entire sort of MO is to try to stay very under the radar. One of my favorite notes from the story is that when you go to Google the firm, try to find an address, which I was doing just trying to get there, the address that shows up on Google isn't actually the firm's address, and I think that kind of characterizes the secretive nature that the firm likes to keep very off the radar. And so this is the first time they have really been in the spotlight in any real way, and I think he thought some of the redistricting stuff for, you know, right or wrong reasons was hurting his firm, and he wanted an opportunity to talk to members of the media and try to sort of in his own voice as opposed to court filing to elaborate on some other reasons why he doesn't think he should be a part of this case and then why he thought some of those documents from his firm should remain private. Just really an opportunity to kind of elaborate on some of the thoughts that are in the court filing.
And Matt, can you speak to what advantage, you know, a political consulting firm, regardless of party affiliation, would have in keeping their work sort of under the radar and in the background?
You know, from a strategic standpoint, I'm not a political consultant, so I'm not exactly sure the benefit. Some consultants are very public. They do media interviews. They enjoy having their face out there. Others are not. And I guess, you know, I've never set up a political consulting shop, so I don't know that I'm the best person to give business management advice here, but I will say that there are groups and firms that have been successful doing both data targeting. You know, there's a very large and in several states across the country, and Pat is doing very well for himself, which is part of the reason he, you know, was involved in the redistricting process. And there are other firms where, you know, I can regularly call and get an on-the-record quote from a consultant, and those guys are doing well. So it's kind of two lines of thought. Some prefer to stay off the record or radar. Some prefer to go public. And there seems to be a way to be successful at doing both.
Right. I just wanted to ask you about that because I was just sort of struck with how successful data targeting has been, and as you mentioned earlier, how they're their website is really just a phone number and an address, and it's not actually their physical address. But Boehner had also opposed the release of those documents based on concerns that it could reveal trade secrets. What sort of trade secrets could Boehner be talking about here? Is this basically concern over revealing potential competitors, you know, insights into how they collect and analyze data, or is it something else?
Right. I mean, data targeting, as the name implies, is kind of big political data before it was, you know, kind of cool. They were back in the 1980s. Everyone does data analysis now, and they were sort of on the cutting edge of that. I guess the thought process with trade secrets is that Pat and data think that they have software or whatever it might be, data analysis tools that they don't want their competitors to see. And we actually quoted him in the story talking about how he thought there were some attempts, because there are plaintiffs in various portions of this case that have ties to National Democrats, and Pat had talked about how he thought that might be an attempt, or at least a side motivation for them, you know, being involved in the suit, is to take a look at take a look at some of his internal workings and some of his data analysis tools. And there's a rather colorful quote in the story from Pat that's talking about that.
So, from Mr. King,
I'd like to respond to that as well, because Mr. Boehner and his documents, there are no trade secrets involved there. No judge that looked at those documents concluded that there were any trade secrets in their documents. It's not a trade secret to secretly go about attempting to subvert the process, the constitutional process. And that's what those documents helped establish that they were doing. Not only were there no trade secrets, but Mr. Boehner's other major argument now is that, this affected his First Amendment associational rights. And what the Supreme Court noted was that you never heard any objection to the production of these documents about associational rights until after Mr. Boehner had spent 6 months trying to keep the documents from being produced in front of Judge Lewis, and he was then held in contempt of court. And at that point, he raised the issue of associational rights under the First Amendment. Supreme Court said that had been totally waived by the delay and the failure to initially raise it when the documents were initially sought. Look, those documents showed, as Mr. Dixon, I know, carefully noted in his article, that there were some emails that talk about the cover-up. They say, be careful the way you refer to this information, what we're doing. Don't let anybody know about it. And one of the operatives working with Mr. Boehner said in an email, we need to be very careful not to mention this in emails. So I guess if you're trying to keep things quiet in emails, you shouldn't send an email confirming that fact.
David King, what is the next step in this ongoing legal battle? Do you know when this case will be back in a courtroom?
Sure. The next step is that we are currently working on the briefs in the Supreme Court. Just to give you a summary of what happened, of course, the court, Judge Lewis in the circuit court in Tallahassee, found that the legislature had violated the Constitution and invalidated their map and required them to go back and have a special session. And they had a special session and did a remedial map, and they made some changes. But we thought the changes that were made were not as significant as they should have been. And consequently, we filed a notice of appeal. It went up to the First District Court of Appeal. They passed it on to the Supreme Court because of the great importance of this matter. And so we're in the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court will hold oral argument on March the 4th of 2015. To consider our appeal of the remedial maps. And then we'll get a decision ultimately from the Supreme Court of Florida on the constitutionality of the remedial map.
Okay. Well, given, as you mentioned earlier, you know, when Judge Lewis threw out the initial maps and the special session was called to redraw them, and given that oral arguments in this case aren't going to happen until March, which is going to be the start of the 2015 legislative session, do you think this is something lawmakers might possibly be able to tackle in the regular session, or do you think they're going to need to call another special session?
Well, it depends on when there is a decision from the Supreme Court. With an argument in March, these things usually take some time. There are just a lot of issues involved. And I don't know whether I can't predict whether there'd be a decision of the Supreme Court before the end of that legislative session or not. If the Supreme Court upsets the remedial map, which is what we're arguing that they should do, then at some point, either the courts will draw another map or the legislature will get another shot at it.
All right. And David, just a final question here, and this is switching gears quite a bit, but it involves another Florida case about recently released documents, and this is about how late last month Governor Scott's administration released nearly 200 pages of emails from a private Google account he had used to conduct state business in violation of Florida's broad public record laws. Initially, Scott's lawyers had said the documents didn't even exist, but now a Leon County Circuit Judge, Charles Francis, has given the okay for attorney Stephen Andrews to amend his own ongoing lawsuit against Scott over property near the governor's mansion. Just based on your legal expertise, do you think Governor Scott could likely face sanctions over the use of that Google account, and what possible sanctions could he face?
Well, I'm not sure about it. If you're involved in the spoliation of evidence intentionally, then there should be sanctions, significant sanctions. You know, it's just disappointing when you're litigating with the government, which you expect to meet a high standard. We have constitutional standards in Florida, in the Fair Districts area. We have open government laws that are supposed to expose all the documents that the government is utilizing. And yet, in our case, in the redistricting case, if we had had to depend on the evidence, the documents that the legislature produced, all of the documents that showed the connections, the interrelationships, the involvement with the political operatives, all those documents were gone, John. They were gone. Just so happened that all those things got destroyed. Now, the legislature had thousands and thousands of pages of documents regarding redistricting. There would be 150 pages of document about how you find a public hearing that was held. You know, they held 26 public hearings before they ultimately passed the legislation. But the stuff about their involvement with the political operatives, that was all gone. And that's one of the things that Judge Lewis noted in his decision. Fortunately, some of those political operatives held on to some of those documents, and we were able to use that information in a very pertinent and important way in the litigation. But it's disturbing that our government seems to have a lot of slippage when it comes to important documents in cases against the government.
Well, that is all the time we have for this portion of the show, but of course we will continue to follow this case. Thank you to my guests, Matt Dixon and David King.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Matt Dixon is an investigative reporter and EW Scripps Capitol Bureau Chief. You can read his work in the Naples Daily News and online at naplesnews.com, among other news publications. David King is an attorney with the League of Women Voters of Florida, which is leading plaintiffs in the ongoing legal battle over how Florida's political districts were redrawn by lawmakers in 2012. We're taking a short break, but when we return, WGCU's Topher Forges takes a look at the problem of sexual assaults on college campuses. The federal government has launched an investigation into more than 50 schools in the U.S., including the University of Florida, over how they handle such cases. We explore how schools here in Southwest Florida and their students are dealing with the issue. That conversation's just ahead. Stay with us. You're listening to WGCU, NPR for Southwest Florida.